This is an interview with Clifford Decker, formerly director of physical plant at Stony Brook in the years 68 to 73. We are at his home in Gainesville, Georgia, Florida. On January 29th, 1987. Cliff, tell us where you came from, what your particular position was before you came to Stony Brook.
You don't have to. This is close enough. You don't have to. Go ahead and talk.
I came to Stony Brook from the University of West Virginia, where I had been on the staff of the physical plant in charge of maintenance for their university hospital. This was prior to 1968. In 68, I came to Stony Brook University.
Who was responsible for your coming, and who interviewed you for the position?
My contact and the person who interviewed me was Sheldon Ackley.
In Dr. Toll's office.
In Dr. Toll's office. Yeah. I'm not sure his exact title.
Administrative assistant, I think. And but you also knew the director of planning, or vice president for planning, Wagner?
Yes, Charlie Wagner and I had worked together at the University of West Virginia, he having the same position there as director of planning and research, and I in the physical plant department.
What was your impression of Stony Brook when you first came? Impression of the physical plant itself and the maintenance staff and the relations with the central office in Albany?
I was greatly impressed by the plans that were, at that point, still in the making. There were, of course, a number of buildings there already, but none of the medical center or anything of that sort had yet been completed. I had very little to do with the actual planning of any of the buildings, although I was aware of what was going on through my contacts with Mr. Wagner.
Was the medical center in the process of being built?
No, it was being built the year that I left, as I recall. Prior to that, we had put up a bunch of temporary buildings to house the first class of medical students.
But was that the south, what's called the South Campus? The Surge buildings?
That would be the same buildings.
The group of six on the South Campus.
Yeah, there were six of them that were originally put there to house the first class of medical students.
Right. I think the library was actually down in East Setauket in an old...
Yeah, down near the fire engine house,
right.
As I recall.
That's right.
Next door in back of it somewhere.
Yeah.
Was a medical library.
That's right. what can you say about the adequacy of the staffing for maintenance, for the maintenance of the campus, as you found it?
As I found it, it was inadequate. But over 20-some years of being in physical plant work at other universities, this seems to be the general rule rather than something that's unusual. The physical plant never catches up.
Right. Can you describe what, can you describe the nature of the heating system, the electrical system, the water system in any way?
The heating system, of course, was a central system with a central boiler house located in the physical plant section of the campus. During my tenure there, all the utilities were put underground. As it is now, it's all underground. Originally, when I first came there in 68, it was not that way. That was one of the projects that was fulfilled during the 5 years I was there, was putting it all underground in, quote, tunnels, which were actually ditches that opened up and then covered over to make tunnels.
Yeah, I see. Right. With whom in the central office did Stony Brook deal in the field of maintenance? Who supervised or second guessed those of us on the Stony Brook campus?
You got me there, Carl. I don't think I could remember any of the names.
Any of the names?
No. In fact, I had very, very few direct contacts with with the upper level, if you want to call it that.
Right. Can you say anything about the elevator system and the results of taking the cheapest or lowest bidder, which seemed to be the state policy?
We always seem to have problems with elevators, but I recall from West Virginia that they had many of the same problems, probably for the very same reasons.
Yes.
I recall a cartoon of when the first astronauts went aloft, the two of them lying on the couch in the module and things, one turning together and saying, "Do you realize this thing was built by the lowest bidder?" And I think sometimes we suffer from that.
Yes. Did maintenance work involve any care of the grounds and the planting or the ordering of plants?
Yes, the grounds department was part of the physical plant operation while I was there. I don't know whether it was ever separated away from it,
right. But
it was part of the physical plant operation then.
I seem to remember Stony Brook's getting a sizable amount of money for planting and trying to get them at the same time to bring in somebody who had training in handling the planting, and they wouldn't give us the money or the line to take care of or to find a, to enable us to find an actual person who was trained.
I believe that must have been after I left Stony Brook. We had a very small group who cut grass and cleaned sidewalks, et cetera, during the winter.
Yeah.
But that was about the extent of the grounds crew then.
No trained person to take.
As I recall, we had no one that was a trained
horticulturist
or anything of that sort, no.
Okay. And as a result, quite a few of the plants died. It was a real waste of money.
Stony Brook was an equal opportunity institution. I suppose you had civil service individuals. How did you get your staff?
The only civil service employees as such, as I recall, now I may be wrong, but as I recall, the only civil service employees were boiler house type individuals, men who attended the boilers and the heating and cooling systems. The rest were hired off the street.
And you couldn't do that?
Oh, yes.
Yes. I see.
But the others, well, they were licensed, let's say, by the state, licensed boiler plant operators and engineers.
I see. What about the quality of the equipment?
They were in the process of upgrading that when I left, too.
They were.
Mm-hmm. At the point where I left, the original equipment was reaching its limit of capacity, mm-hmm. and therefore they were having to increase the capacity of the present boiler, that present boiler house, or go to individual heating systems and buildings as they were constructed. And I believe there were a couple coming on that had their own systems. Now, I'm not sure of that either.
Right. Remember, there was a chap by the name of Joe something who was a good bowler. And he was in the boiler house, pretty sure. Did you have any connection with the furniture or the equipping of the buildings?
No, only in the sense of providing labor to help tote it in when it would be delivered.
I see.
Like, I remember one year, one set of dorms that were very, very late, and we had to rush to get them furnished for the fall term. And they used everybody that we could find, laborers, skilled carpenters, anybody that would come and work carried furniture, but not procurement.
I think they were trying to avoid tripling.
That was the student discussion at that point in time, was tripling.
Yeah. Did you have any input into the planning for new buildings as they came under discussion?
I recall attending a couple of meetings at different times where new buildings were being discussed. But as to actually sitting down and working with designers and architects and so forth, no. It was, I think, a local level get-together.
Yeah. Buildings were usually planned. And along with it, whatever equipment in the way of furniture, or in the case of laboratories, types of laboratories, gas, water, electricity, that sort of thing. The appropriations included not only the appropriation for the building, but for the necessary equipment. Those who did the planning also apparently did the planning for the equipment and supporting facilities. But they didn't ask you much.
No, I personally had very little input into that. What you say is correct.
Yeah.
They came delivered, ready for use, with all the equipment required.
Did you have any connection with Myron Doucette? He was the assistant in the president's office for scientific equipment.
Very, very little. I knew him on a hello, yeah. How are you basis, not yeah. really on any right. working basis.
Right. Do you have any impressions of the way the students maintained the dormitories? Student life in the dormitories.
That was probably one of the biggest problems that I had while at Stony Brook, was the fact that sometimes it seemed their only purpose in life was to utterly destroy them. It seemed that way, at least. They certainly did not in any way try to care for what was provided for them, let's put it that way.
This was, would you say this was a pretty general characteristic of the student body, or a characteristic of a small minority, or half of them? What would you say?
I would say it was probably a majority.
Majority of them.
Now, there were some who cared about their surroundings, but for the most part, it seemed to me that their one joy in life in the evening was tearing the place up.
Would you say that they were not housebroken?
Depends on what you describe as housebroken. For one thing, we had two painters who went around doing nothing but painting out nasty graffiti, not cute graffiti, nasty graffiti.
Yeah.
And they did that 5 days a week. That was their full-time job, mm-hmm. just as a for instance.
We were educating other people's children.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. Do you have any impression of the days in the 60s that were the result of our being in Vietnam? Student behavior of any kind?
Well, of course, a lot of their protest was regarding
recruitment
on the campus by various corporations, which they did not consider to be the nicest.
Dow chemical,
etc. Yes.
What about drugs? Had they come out the island and become a problem at the university in your time?
Yes, they were a problem while I was there. We had a couple of, quote, drug busts while I was there.
Yeah. Did you ever see the brochure prepared by the local Suffolk County Police for the particular drug bust in 68, a 6-inch brochure handed out and given to the television and newspaper people?
I don't recall ever having had the opportunity to see that.
Yeah. They got it together. It was quite a production. In general, any recollections of people individuals with whom you worked, individual students?
I remember one summer hiring about a half a dozen boys. I think Alec Pond sent them down to our office. They were the ringleaders of the dissident students.
Oh, uh-huh.
And they were planning on something they were going to do all over the summer to be ready for the fall term. And they had everything. They had a place to stay at one of the dorms, but they had to have some way to earn some money to feed themselves. So Alex sent them down and asked if we could put them to work. And I remember it was quite an experience for me, because he warned me that these were the kids that were the toughies, quote unquote. So they came down, and I think there were five or six of these young fellows, and they came into my office, and I must say they went through the proper channels. They came in and asked for to see the head of the department the whole way any businessman would do, which kind of surprised me to begin with. And at the time of the interview, I told them that I would put them to work, that they would probably get all kinds of menial jobs, pushing a broom with a custodial force, digging the ditch with the laborers. You know, it could be anything in the way of menial, unskilled labor. But they seemed to be glad to have it, because they wanted, as they said, eating money. And during the course of our conversation, the one, and I can't recall his name now, but I remember at the time, he was the one whose name was always in the paper when something happened.
Mitch Cohen?
Mitch Cohen.
Right.
Right. Mitch Cohen says, "Mr. Decker, are you sure that we have these jobs?" He says, "You know, this a lot depends on this." "Yes, Mitch, you have a job." During the course of our conversation, which lasted maybe 20 minutes or so, three or four times he kept coming back, "Are you sure we have a job?" "Yes, Mitch, you have a job." And finally, after about four or five times, I became disgusted. I said, "Look, I told you you had a job. Now you got it. What's your problem?" And his answer floored me. He said, "I'm a senior at Stony Brook. You're the first person in an administrative spot that's ever given me a direct yes." He said, "I had to hear you repeat it." And I thought afterwards, perhaps that was a sign of the times we were living in at that time. Not anything about any other person in the administration, but our society at that time. These kids were looking for someone to tell them yes or no. If the case be no, tell them no.
Yeah.
And they turned out to be fairly decent employees for the summer.
Good.
No problems.
Yeah. While you were there, what individuals stood out in your mind as contributing to the growth of the institution? And the little light comes on.
I can't say that I could pick out any particular individual and say that he or she was outstanding, because I had a limited amount of contact with the people who were doing the long-range planning. When it came down to the point where a building was under consideration, I would sometimes be called in to sit in meetings at Charlie Wagner's office. And my impression at that time was that he and his staff and the department people for whom the building was being planned were a very dedicated bunch of people. They were interested in the welfare of the university and its growth, and were doing all that they could to make the most of what they had available to them in the way of funding and so forth.
What was the impression you had of the funding, the amount of funding available in the late 60s?
At the time I arrived at Stony Brook, money was still free-flowing for maintenance, free-flowing for construction, free-flowing for everything. The tougher times had not set in yet, and my short tenure there, I enjoyed good financial backing, I guess you'd call it. Financially, we were backed. I never seemed to be able to catch up with the lines for necessary individuals in various trades and so forth for the physical plant.
Do you know whether the lines were asked for by the local campus?
I was assured that they were.
Yes.
That's all I can say.
And they were cut in Albany somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
Right.
Somewhere up there.
Up there, right. This is the end of the interview with Clifford Decker. This is the beginning of an interview with Richard Schmidt, formerly acting president at Stony Brook for a year, following the departure of T. Alexander Pond. Dr. Schmidt was president of the Upstate Medical School in Syracuse and asked to fill in for a year until they could find a successor to Dr. Pond. He was a neurologist and did a splendid job at Stony Brook. Everybody liked him. The interview was taking place at the home of the Deckers in Gainesville, Florida. The date is the morning of January 30th, 87. I want to ask you a few questions about the time that you were acting president at Stony Brook.
All right.
What was your position when you came to Stony Brook?
Well, I had been president of the State University campus in Syracuse, the Upstate Medical Center, which has since changed its name, by the way. It's now Science Center at Syracuse. It was in April, or I think it was in April. One morning I was in my office early, before the secretarial staff got there or anything else. And I had a direct call from, without going through any secretaries, from Chancellor Wharton. And much to my surprise, he asked me to consider going to Stony Brook as a temporary assignment. Without thinking, I said, of course, which I guess was, I don't know whether I should have done it or shouldn't have done it, but I did it. Didn't even ask my wife at the time whether it would be suitable with her. And it all went on from there, and I physically moved to Stony Brook effective on the 1st of June.
What year?
That year. That was 1979, wasn't it?
79. How did Chancellor Wharton describe the situation at Stony Brook?
We didn't have much description of it. Most of the time I was familiar in general with it, as one would be for another campus in the state university. He did tell me about the difficulties they had had in the recruitment and identification of a new permanent president, and the division between within the consul at Stony Brook and between the consul majority and the trustees of the state university, in fairly general terms, and also outlined that
He wanted somebody who would not be a candidate for the permanent position. That was about it. Very little beyond that, as I recall.
Did he describe the differences between the council and the trustees?
I became aware of them. I was actually aware in general terms before he called.
I see.
And as you well know, within a university, there's a great deal of, some of it would be classified as gossip, but let's call it news.
Yes.
instead of that, in the frequent meetings we had in Albany and so forth, this was reviewed a lot of times in hallway conversation, sometimes magnified and sometimes just superficially. Mm-hmm. But in general terms, I was aware that there was deep division on the campus and that of the division between the council and of the trustees.
Mm-hmm. When you got to Stony Brook, what was your impression of the university at the time?
I found it rather deeply divided into camps, and perhaps a bit more hostility, faculty, students, staff, than let's say one could constructively say that aggressivity and hostility would be normal. One of the biggest impressions that I had, formed almost immediately, was of the exceptionally high quality of groups of faculty who had been recruited, of polarization among different groups, including the students, and of the general rather low esteem for the what I would call the quality of life. There was a great deal of vandalism on the campus on the part of students. There were fairly radical elements for which there was a past reputation, and things which had happened years before were frequently in the gossip mill as well. This happened yesterday again. One time, I guess there had been a drug raid. This kept coming up as it happening every
back
day.
Back in '68,
and that was years before. But you'd hear that it just happened yesterday, and things of that nature. I felt there was a need of trying to bring groups together, of trying to improve on such things as the quality of life, the attention to the meeting the needs of people, not strictly the needs of academic reputation, research, and things of that nature. I had an impression also almost immediately, which was an expansion of prior experience of the great difficulties in operating a campus of that size with strictures in the budgets which were occurring, and particularly by the very excessive pre-audit or external control which took decisions into multiple stage decision-making within state government in Albany.
Right. That was... It was a situation going back to the framework of New York State government and the characteristics of the process of decision making with all of the other state agencies. The university was just one of the other state agencies.
Just one of the other agencies.
Yes.
It was treated as an agency. And I guess there were differences or nominal differences, but there one can certainly defend a level of oversight by the government, which is ultimately responsible for the university, but it was an extensive multiple step and multiple area of approval and pre-audit of so many decisions.
Right. Can you be specific about the nature of the divisions, either the divisions within the faculty or the divisions between students and university staff? You say that there were divisions and some aggressive behavior on both sides? Or?
On both sides, one that was immediately obvious and actually did not ultimately become a major factor had been the division between the supporters and the opponents of the candidate that had been submitted for presidency, Dr. Pond, which I had been warned that that was going to be a big difficulty and so on. Actually, it turned out not to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was there, but it did not come as a major part. Within the faculty, within the Senate, for example, there appeared to be a continual harangue between administration and the president's office and people in the Senate, which seemed to improve as time went on. It wasn't perfect. Some of the people who were, let's say, habitual opponents of administration and spoke out cleverly sometimes, not cleverly at others in faculty Senate meeting. The students, there are different groups of students who demonstrated, if you will, at the drop of a hat. There was a group that had identified itself as communist. There had been a group that called itself, I think, the Red Balloon. There was another group which used to put signs all over the campus, which concerned itself nominally with a big concern of all of us, namely combating racism, but it didn't seem to be the underlying purpose of that group, but other more radical agendas. There were divisions of the main campus and the Health Science Center, where very large investments were being made, where the
in the Health Science
in
Center.
The Health Science
yes.
Center,
right,
and where things had not been done on time, everything from construction and opening of the university hospital to the differential salary and supplemental income arrangements with the faculty, and particularly in the College of Medicine, which caused a considerable difference among them. A lot of the troubles had to do with the maintenance of the physical plant. Many things had to be deferred, so that it was not a tranquil appearing campus. You can walk on an older, more established campus and have an idea of being in a site of beauty or tranquility or isolation from the troubles of the world, where one can, maybe this is idealized and a Mr. Chips type of
yes.
thing, but
right.
one does get this many times on a campus of a university.
Right.
This looked more like an industrial center in a way.
The trees hadn't grown up.
The trees hadn't grown. People didn't have respect or love. I rather quickly and jokingly offered a prize to anyone who would write an alma mater, which would be guaranteed and bring tears to the eyes of alumni. Somebody actually tried to write this, a very brilliant student who was graduating that year did compose a tune and song, which she thought would be good alma mater. It seemed that different student groups were against each other. It was the means that were seemed to be used to get across the ideas that was perhaps almost could be put into something which could be called the importance of etiquette. People just didn't seem to respect each other, and there were great harangues instead of sitting down and solving the problems. That there would be demands made. I was denounced on more than one occasion in demonstrations by people that didn't even know me.
Were simply administration.
I was simply administration, right. And whatever that was. And I was named administration.
Yes. Right. That's a function partly of the background from which our student body largely came from. Or would you say that? Perhaps not.
Statistically, that appears to be true. For example, the vandalism on the campus, which was certainly excessive and very disagreeable, the studies have shown that vandalism on a campus is more likely to be a freshman student drunk and from a large metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. And we were certainly from a large metropolitan area. Being near one of the largest in the United States, New York City.
Right. What do you consider to have been your contribution to the ongoing of Stony Brook?
I tried not to be just a caretaker.
Yes.
Which was one of the functions which I could have taken on very consciously trying to hold things together and not shake anything up or not do anything, as it were, until the new president was recruited. I put a lot of attention to trying to get faculty administration and student body together in a more collegial atmosphere. And to the extent that I succeeded at Stony Brook, I would say that this would be the major achievement which I would look upon. That we tried to do this in a number of different ways. Some of it, perhaps with my perverse sense of humor,
You were very well liked. Everything that I got in the way of scuttlebutt indicated that you were a focal point of approval, both from the standpoint of purpose and the standpoint of your methods. Now, that's because I was on the outside, but people would have been happy to have you stay on, at least the people I knew.
That was not to be.
Yes.
There were some suggestions about that during the time that I was there.
Yeah.
But I had made a commitment to myself, the institution from which I came, and to the chancellor and the board of trustees, that I would not be a candidate under any circumstances. We stuck to that, and although it was brought up on more than one occasion, it was never seriously put forward. And I was very pleased at the end when they did recruit a highly capable new president who had considerable vigor and was a highly respected individual both in his scientific field and in his prior administrative appointment in Southern California.
He was screened back on the campus at Southern California.
In other words, they checked carefully.
Oh, yes. Yes, he was dean of the, I've forgotten the exact title of it.
I think he was academic vice president, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Also a physicist, which seemed to be the tradition.
Seems to be the tradition.
I don't think they have recruited him because he was a physicist, but because of his energy, the sense he seemed to put together, and his desire to face a very tough challenge.
Mm-hmm. What would you say about the toughness of the challenge at Stony Brook?
It was tough. I look back upon that 13 months, however, as one of the most challenging, and really one of the most challenging and also most rewarding and ultimately pleasant experiences of my life.
Good.
Mm-hmm. I leave it to others to judge whether I accomplished everything, but I have the self-feeling that put it directly, did something important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my late wife, Betty, also did something important.
She was able to play the role of the wife of the president with regard, vis-a-vis the faculty wives.
Yes.
And do it well. That's important. Extremely important.
I guess another accomplishment, I don't know how much I had to do with it, but I had something to do with it, which was a major administrative challenge for some of the reasons that we have talked about before, was the final opening of the University Hospital.
Yes.
Which one could never consider it done until it was actually done with the multiple approvals to go through. Everything from the approvals of purchasing the equipment to the computer program for it, to getting the raccoons out of the walls of the building, which they set up house during its construction, I think it was one of the more humorous things of it. I think people actually got pictures of the raccoons in the walls way up at the top. We had a delivery system for things from one place to the other, which was quite difficult getting started, which was a very expensive, very modern idea of a computer-controlled delivery system for everything from charts to medication, which had some defects in it. It had been started by one company and finished by another. The people who installed it many of them were not able to, they had been sent from another country and they couldn't speak English. So they had difficulty communicating with the master architect, but we used to say this was the railroad system for the raccoons in the walls. Other things which maybe more apocryphal than true in memory. One was in the purchase of some of the equipment, which illustrated the difficulty of doing things by people at a distance who were really not knowledgeable. Somebody decided that the purchase order for artificial hip was too big for one order, so they ordered the different parts from different companies that didn't fit together, so it was completely useless. There are multiple examples such as that throughout the university. But we finally got it open, and I suspect it's thriving, although I have no direct knowledge of it now.
Seems to be. I think they're up around 450 beds now.
Are they?
And the reputation of the individuals
including D, for instance, from England, orthopedics man.
Good.
Very good. Very, very high.
They recruited certainly outstanding people in many areas, and had people who were outstanding in many scientific and non-scientific fields, and it had the essentials of developing into a great university. I think it still has those essentials. Some of the targets of the original thought may be beyond achievable levels with the strictures of budgeting, the
lack of numbers. What were some of the targets?
The targets were rather directly stated many times, such as to be the Berkeley of the East. And
that sounds like John Toll.
That sounded like him, and this was stated explicitly, as I remembered, in the publicity surrounding the report of the Middle States visit.
The Heald report, to an institution to stand with the finest.
Yes.
In the nation.
And I think it had that potential. One of the things which perhaps was not achieved has to do with the size. It grew beyond perhaps the demand for by students of a university of that type on Long Island, and the targets of enrollment upon which some things of sizing, budgeting, buildings, and so forth were placed were not achieved, and as I understand it, have not been achieved now. And many universities are consolidating a bit in terms of size of student body, which unfortunately in the formula makers of budget comes to how much budget there is.
That's right. It's somewhere between 17,000 and 18,000 now in size. There had been talk 20 years ago of 28,000 or at least 20,000, yeah. That sort of thing. The discussion of the writing of a history of the early years made it well, the discussion took place in the feeling. Took place in an atmosphere of pride and excitement, feeling that somehow a record of this rapid development of a first-rate institution should be accounted for. And then they were a little unsure of just what time span the history should include. The 25th year was passed by without any history. And they were thinking of the 25th year on the Stony Brook campus, but actually that would have been the 30th year, so they shelved the idea of writing a history. But during the discussion, it became clear that a lot of the source material in people's heads no longer was available. The three governors had died, Dewey, Harriman, and Rockefeller. The chairman of the Board of Trustees, Frank Moore, was dead. One of the presidents, Tom Hamilton, was dead. our first dean on the Stony Brook campus, Stan Ross, was dead. The chairman of the council, Judge Sullivan, was dead. And so it became clear that if you're going to have any of the information that was in people's minds, you had to get it down orally on a tape before they left the land of the living. And so this is what I was asked to do, and I agreed to do it, even though I'm also working on my own project. And a call has gone out for faculty folders, files, to be sent into the special collections, the archives, and also recollections if they want to get them down either on tape or in writing. I'm interviewing people who are off campus and not part of the faculty. You're one of them.
Well, thank you.
Can you think of anything else? Sometimes it's a question of the questions that I ask of you.
Well, the thing that I intended to do, or that my reason for being at Stony Brook was largely accomplished. One was that my appointment turned out to be non-controversial as far as me being the personal choice. And some of those who had held rather difficult positions before me were very courteous and did not show resentment because of my presence.
Who?
Specifically, people who had been very close to Dr. Pond and Dr. Pond himself. He was very helpful to me, did not intrude or try to influence me, but was a valuable source of information and of insight. Was very friendly, and did not reveal to me any evidence of personal bitterness or the like. And this was rather general. Mm-hmm. One faculty member who had been, I was told that he was a very difficult person with whom to deal, a prominent leader on the faculty. Some even said that he was granted an unusual sabbatical in order to get him out of the way for a period of time when he came back early on in my own administration. And we spoke together very frankly, and I rather liked him, and I think we became friends.
You want to say the name?
He was in sociology.
Norman Goodman?
Goodman, yeah. We teased each other a little bit, I think, on the floor of the Senate, I was very touched on the, just before I left Stony Brook, that he came to see me. I had just made a decision with respect to tenure for a member of the faculty of his department,